Hello, you're listening to Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. Today on the show, we're talking about near-death experiences.
Life, the Universe, and Everything Else is a program promoting secular humanism and scientific skepticism that is produced by the Winnipeg Skeptics and the Humanists, Atheists, and Agnostics of Manitoba. You can email your questions, comments, or criticisms to us at lueepodcast@winnipegskeptics.com. Show notes, references, and relevant links for all episodes can be found at lueepodcast.wordpress.com or at winnipegskeptics.com/blog.
Hello and welcome. My name is Donna Harris, and with me today is Greg Christensen. You're welcome to what is essentially, let's call it Near-Death Experiences 101. What I'm going to do is I'll start the show with talking about what a near-death experience is, what are their common characteristics, and a brief rundown of their probable explanations. What exactly are near-death experiences? Well, they generally happen when someone has been pronounced clinically dead or has been very close to death. And of course, in the last several decades, with recent developments in cardiac resuscitation techniques, the number of reported NDEs has increased. Depending on what expert you consult, there are anywhere from about 8 to about 16 common elements to these NDEs. A lot of these will sound pretty familiar to most of us. Here's a list of 10 most common elements of near-death experiences. An awareness of being dead, a feeling of positive emotions, and a lot of people explain this as absolute joy or bliss or just happiness. Moving through a tunnel, a communication with light. They may see different colors and see different ranges of colors that actually have emotions to them. Observation of a celestial landscape. Meeting with deceased persons. Now, often we've heard, you meet your deceased mother or you see other godlike figures, angels, things like that. A life review, the old saying, your life flashes before your eyes. And the presence of a border that people say that they have a very strong sense that that's a border that they cannot cross. If they cross that border, then they're not coming back. One thing that they note is experiences for these NDEs are unique and individual. No two NDEs are the same. There's no single feature in every single one. So they probably all will not have all of those features. What has been most commonly noted is intense feelings of peace, joy, and love, and an encounter with that loving light. And sometimes experiences like that are reported that are exactly the opposite. Instead of joy and love, the individual experiences the opposite emotions, so extreme fear and isolation, confusion, even torment or guilt. So they're having a bad day. Certain studies have pegged the percentage of these NDEs at anywhere between 6 and 18% of all the ones that have been reported. So that's basically elements of near-death experiences. When people start looking at the reasons for them, what are an explanatory model that can explain these? They fall under kind of three categories. There are psychological theories, there are physiological theories, and there are also transcendental models. So first, psychological theories have suggested that the NDE may be a consequence of mental or emotional reactions to the perceived threat of dying, or the expectation even. Other psychological factors might include the imagination of the person, depersonalization, and if the person is even prone to fantasy. Next area that they've included as an explanatory model are the physiological theories. These are the ones based in the physical, the body itself. And they're kind of split up into the physical itself, biological, or pharmacological explanations. Some of the physical causes that have been considered by researchers include the lack of oxygen in the brain, obviously, or diminished levels of oxygen, or the opposite, increased levels of carbon dioxide in the blood, which may also have an impact. Endorphins in the blood, serotonin levels, or various neurotransmitters, even seizures. Activation of the limbic system in our brain, which is basically the very old, reptilian part of our brain. Certain drugs may have something to do with it. Retinal ischemia, which I had to look up, I must confess, and that refers to loss of blood to the eye. So if people's eyes are not functioning correctly, that may lend itself to seeing lights and distorted images, things like that. Even processes related to REM sleep or the phenomenon bordered, on that border between sleep and wakefulness. Now, the third type of explanation is, of course, transcendental. This implies that the NDE is a profound event and that can't be explained by using only psychological or physiological theories. This is the model that kind of challenges the traditional understanding of the mind-brain relationship. There are actually researchers in the field who are looking at all three of these models, and they've actually expressed some reservations towards explanations that are purely psychological or physiological. Instead, they've argued for the inclusion of transcendental elements, and they're talking about the mind-brain relationship and the possibilities of our consciousness, so suggesting there may be actually something beyond that. And on that note, I'm now joined by Greg Christensen, who is going to weigh in on that topic for us about the possibilities of a transcendental explanation. Okay, so when we consider the transcendental explanation for near-death experiences, which really does say that there may be something more to these experiences than what we may consider as skeptics, some researchers are suggesting that there may be something more than just purely psychological or physiological to these. Instead, there may be possibilities of human consciousness and the mind-brain relationship. Now, what that leads us to is the most common explanation that we're familiar with as anyone's near-death experiences. Oh my gosh, heaven is real. I have met Jesus and God, and I've seen my deceased grandmother Ruthie. And I mean, the bookstore shelves are filled with stories written by these folks who are convinced that they've been to heaven and that they've had a true experience here. Now, Greg, we were just talking about... Oh, excuse me, I didn't introduce. Greg Christensen, say hello to our audience.
Hello.
Thank you. Greg is joining me for this portion of the discussion. And we're going to get down and skeptical on some of these types of transcendental explanations. The one that comes to mind, of course, is this new movie that just opened up recently. It's called Heaven is for Real. And what it puts on the screen is the story of a young fellow, little boy, 4-year-old boy, named Colton Burpo, and he was the son of a small-town Nebraska pastor. And what Colton experienced was heaven during emergency surgery. He talks about looking down to see the doctor operating and his dad praying in the waiting room and all that. So pastor dad listened to the boy, wrote about it, wrote a book, and now it's been turned into a movie. And what would... Greg, are you going to go see this movie?
No, because I'd probably start screaming.
I think I would agree. What would be the biggest turnoff to you, then, about something like this kind of experience?
Oh, I mean, the same thing that turns me off from pretty much any kind of Christian apologetics or whatever, it's... like the flimsiest of evidence, the secondhand accounts from a 4-year-old who is, I mean, undoubtedly, you know, is it any kind of coincidence that his dad's a preacher? Did he have an NDE and then come back and say, "Whoa, the Vikings were right. It's Valhalla. We got to change our ways like right away." You know, no, of course not. I mean, the NDE experiences that Christians have are of, you know, a Judeo-Christian afterlife. I'm pretty sure that the exact same experiences, you know, documented on the other side of the planet reveal a completely different pantheon, you know, a completely different experience of the afterlife. Those who have horrible self-confidence issues and unresolved issues with guilt may come back and say they experienced hell. You know, I've heard of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's all just a manifestation of what's already in your mind.
I had actually seen that as well with looking at some of the reading that I was doing, that people will experience culturally appropriate deities and things like that that kind of make sense for their own beliefs and their own knowledge, their own understanding.
Right.
I think that's part of the crux and the problem with NDEs is that I have no doubt for a second that these experiences do happen. I believe that people go through something. I don't think it has anything to do with the supernatural. But the problem with them is that you have to rely on the person's self-reporting of what their experience was. And it's very difficult to do any scientific research, I would imagine, on that. Another example that I read this book last year, and I was kind of under-impressed with it, is a book called Proof of Heaven, and it's written by Eben Alexander. He's a medical doctor. He was a neurosurgeon and who thought he knew how the brain and the mind worked, but he had a real near-death experience. He was he was in the brink of death and in a coma with this very serious brain infection. But when he awoke, he had the very typical NDE experience, and that changed his life. Now, I really don't understand how somebody who has an experience and knowledge of how the brain works could be convinced that they've had a true NDE like that, that they've experienced the supernatural somehow.
How can you have a creationist oncologist? That still blows my mind. I mean, that's, I don't know if you were there, but I'm referencing the same, when the Winnipeg Skeptics went to the creationist museum and dinosaur exhibit in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
They had one of the member of the clergy of the church, well, not the clergy, just a congregation, happened to be an oncologist, right? So, I mean, Monday to Friday, he's an oncologist. Saturday, Sunday, and evenings and weekends, I guess, he's a young earth creationist. And, I mean, he was there to put as much spin and revel in ignorance as possible. You know, but, I digress now, right? I mean, we can absolutely demonstrate the ability to separate our intellect from our wishful thinking, our capacity for supernatural beliefs. You know, you take a look at his name's escaping me, the Genome Project guy.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know his name either.
Francis Collins, I think it is, isn't it?
That's another name I was thinking of.
Evolution, Language of God. But here's a link to his Wikipedia page. In any event, he's an American physician, geneticist, noted for his discoveries of discoveries of disease genes and his leadership on the Human Genome Project. He serves as director for the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland.
Oh, okay.
So he wrote the New York Times bestseller, The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. And he cites, I mean, it's the same old thing over and over and over again. He cites C.S. Lewis, St. Augustine, Stephen Hawking, no doubt out of context, Charles Darwin, no doubt out of context. I mean, it's... like, I really don't want to use the word, but it's almost like blasphemy, you know. When you hear a scientist or a great thinker, you know, I mean, just betray evidence, reason, the scientific method, critical thinking, to hold on to this belief that they've segmented away from, you know, the rest of science and the rest of how they process reality. It's very frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there may be some kind of unresolved issue in their lives then that leads them back to religion for some reason, whether it be a trauma in their life or some type of fear of death? I don't know.
We all have a fear of death on, I suppose, some level. I suppose, like, I mean, I'd like to say that I don't fear death or being dead, but I fear, I guess, the process and the transition. I hope it will be quick and painless, for me. But I mean, I couldn't really, I think it would be very presumptuous and arrogant of me to try and play psychologist and diagnose the fears and rationale of, you know,
True.
Other people's deep beliefs that, you know, they hold to be very sincere. All I can really do is just ask for, you know, the best evidence that they've got and try and evaluate it critically.
Okay. So speaking then of evidence, and we're looking, if we want to look at near-death experiences with a scientific eye that relies more on research and evidence, then I would recommend, and this is a book that I found quite interesting, it's called Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of the Near-Death Experience. And it's written by a European cardiologist. His name is Pim van Lommel. He has also written papers on the subject. And this is interesting because one of the main areas, as I mentioned earlier, is with the number of people surviving cardiac arrest these days and being resuscitated, you'll have a lot more people remembering or having near-death experiences. Now, he was a cardiologist, this van Lommel, and so many of his patients claim to have near-death experiences with the heart attacks that he actually tried to design, and he did, design a research study in a controlled environment in a cluster of hospitals. So they studied that for almost 20 years. In 2001, he and his researchers published their study in The Lancet, and it was really the first scientifically rigorous study. What he does in this book, he goes over the elements of the NDEs. He talks about different experiences. And from his experience, when he's seen these patients, and I'll try a little quote here, that he's convinced that a near-death phenomenon is an authentic experience, and it can't just be attributed to all the things that we've talked about, imagination, psychosis, oxygen deprivation. In his opinion, the current views on the relationship between the brain and the consciousness are too narrow. He actually suggests that our consciousness may not always coincide with brain functions, and remarkably and significantly, consciousness can be experienced separate from the body, which I guess is his ultimate conclusion. Now, he really interesting book. He doesn't go out and say that he believes there's some transcendental thing out there, but what he suggests is that he thinks there's something to this, but he's recommending a lot more research and study. And I thought that was a very reasonable conclusion, considering his closeness to the subject, because he's studied these people for a couple of decades.
Well, yeah, I can appreciate and absolutely get on board with more research. Research, mm-hmm. research, right? I mean, although I really have to disagree with the assertion that consciousness can somehow exist outside or a part of the mind or body. It's clearly, you know, a product. I mean, I can alter my consciousness by taking a physical substance, you know, mm-hmm. like i.e. hallucinogenic drugs. There is no me separate from my mind and the chemistry of my brain. A head injury
could
damage my brain, right? Well, some head injuries, you know, like, you know, not all of them, but you know, that could fundamentally change who I am. And I mean, there is no, like, so that conclusion, I mean, it's wherever he's starting from to get that point is so far removed from, I think, any kind of reality or picture of reality that we know. I just don't see where he's getting that.
I'd have to read the book again. This was two or three years that I read it. But I respected his assertion at the time. But, I you know, take it with a grain of salt. When I was researching this topic, I also came across, you know Michael Shermer, of course, Greg, right?
Yes.
Michael Shermer went, and I'm trying to find my notes on this, and I probably will not remember the name of the researcher, but he tried on the God helmet. And it was by this fellow called Persinger,
mm-hmm.
Who's a researcher. And he's developed the God helmet that, you know, a subject will go in there for an hour. And basically what it is, it's magnetic pulses that affect the brain.
Yeah.
And what Shermer remembers or experienced during that was a sense that there was somebody else passing by him, another being or an entity outside of him, and he also experienced a sense of briefly being out of his body.
Yeah, Richard Dawkins has also described a similar experience.
Right. So that's but only one partial experience of what people say happened to them during NDEs, because they'll experience the light, the tunnel, the sense of peace and joy, seeing deceased relatives. So it's part of the experience, but not all of it. Same with the drugs that they've also tried to induce to have a similar experience, things like that. All of these bits of research show parts of it, but it's not the whole experience by far.
Have you looked into the 5-stage continuum of an NDE?
No.
Apparently, I'm just cruising the Wikipedia article here.
Okay.
Stage 1 is peace. Stage 2 is body separation. Stage 3 is entering darkness. Stage 4 is seeing the light. And stage 5 is entering the light. 60% experience stage 1, but only 10% make it to stage 5. Which is interesting, because one would think once you enter the light, that's it. That's the universal symbol for giving up. But this is Kenneth Ring, 1980, subdivided the NDE on a 5-stage continuum.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what body of work that's from, or let me take a look at who Kenneth Ring is. He is a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Connecticut and the researcher within the field of near-death studies.
Ooh.
He is the co-founder and past president of the International Association for Near-Death Studies and founding editor of the Journal of Near-Death Studies.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so Ken Ring. I remember this, folks, in the show notes, if you're interested in following us here. That would be a website that I would direct you to if you want more information. The International Association for Near-Death Study. Their website is IANDS.org. I was, looking through there when I was researching this as well, and I didn't realize Ken Ring was part of this. I didn't realize anybody had staged the experiences in order, so to speak. So other sources I had cited or looked at had just, lumped all the experiences together and not suggested that there was a staging to them, that one followed another. It's very interesting.
So his academic journal is listed as in Wikipedia as being peer-reviewed. A long time ago, there was an episode where we were discussing science and so forth. It was you and I were actually both on it. It was the climate change one, where Rochelle ran us through how to determine a good scientific journal from a bad scientific journal.
Right.
I believe it was influence factor or something to that effect.
Okay.
So, for example, you can have a peer-reviewed journal, but that doesn't necessarily, it's called impact factor.
Okay.
The Journal of Near-Death Studies has an impact factor of 0.00.
That sounds low. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that sounds pretty low.
Let's just take a look at this here. Impact factor, 0.00. 5-year impact, 0.00. I would assume that separates something that was maybe impactful several years ago. Like let's say you and I were famous scientists and we had our own journal and we were moving and shaking, and then all of a sudden Neil deGrasse Tyson comes along just because he's cool.
Okay. Oh, Neil's very cool.
Yeah, and says Donna and Greg have it all wrong. Perhaps our 5-year impact factor and our impact factor might produce a different number. If you do happen to get Rochelle on, maybe she can clarify this. Mm-hmm. Cited half-life, 0.00. Immediacy index, 0.00. Eigenfactor, 0.00. Article influence, 0.00. Methinks we have a fake. I mean, okay, mm-hmm. Sure. It's a scientific journal in name only.
Right, right.
It's seriously. Okay. I'm taking a look at some of the other things here. Like I'm just kind of on a, impact factor here, here are some other journals that you might be interested in.
Right.
European Journal of Cardiothoracic Surgery, Impact Factor 2.4. Resuscitation. European Resuscitation Council, Impact Factor 4.1. So it does seem to go up from zero, folks.
It does. It does. Very well done, Greg. Very well done.
Yay for me. American Journal of Public Health, 3.93. Yeah, near-death experiences. Like, I'm certainly not closing the door on an actual study. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, if I can just vaguely recall, I think there have been a few studies done with a critical eye, like, for example, placing an open file folder, right? Like, you know, just your average office file folder with some papers with large, clear text on top of a filing cabinet where nobody can see it except for floating disembodied spirits. And the people who have the NDE are unable to tell you what's on top of the filing cabinet when they come back in.
Greg, I'm going to say we didn't plan this, but are you finished with that statement?
I agree.
Sure. Yep.
Because that leads me into my next research study. I'm interested in this one. I don't know if you've ever heard of there's another researcher called Sam Parnia, and he has been doing for the last few years a study based on that thing alone. Because yes, I've read the stories about people who were in, say they were in the operating room, they died and they heard the surgeons talking. The one fellow, I think there's something about his false teeth. Honestly, I think he heard the nurse put his false teeth in a drawer and they couldn't find them after, and he told them where to find them. That kind of anecdote is the only thing that we've seen.
Well, you don't think that you can, that if you're in some sort of a light slumber, you can still, your brain can still process information?
Exactly. And that is why there's no proof to these kinds of anecdotes. And that's exactly my point, that these are all self-reported in that sense. But that is what this study has been doing. It's called the AWARE study, and it's called Awareness During Resuscitation. It's been several years now. It's studying the relationship between consciousness and the quality of cerebral resuscitation and its outcome. So patients are being examined qualitatively immediately after their cardiac arrest, as well as at regular intervals. Now, they've used this study of consciousness includes the use of independent markers designed to objectively examine the validity of survivors' claims of being able to see and hear during cardiac arrest. And that's exactly what they're doing. They are putting the items high up in the room where nobody else knows they're there. And the interesting part about this is I just checked it. There's an update for 2014 for this study. They reached out to this researcher, Dr. Parnia. He explained that the results of the first phase of the AWARE study have been completed and have been submitted for publication, in a medical journal. The study results are now undergoing peer review, so it'll be a few more months. But I think that I'm anxious to see what this holds, if they actually found anything or if they didn't.
Now, remember, folks, peer review isn't everything, right? I mean, it's a great tool. But if you're peer reviewed in a journal that has an impact factor of 0.00, you know, I'm just going to throw it out there.
Exactly. We'll see. We'll see if it actually gets published, and we'll see if it's peer reviewed and things like that. So it doesn't say anything about what publication they've been submitted to or anything. So, and it could disprove them entirely. It could really debunk the whole thing that people actually really, you know, leave their bodies and things like that. So. It'll be an interesting study. I'll be waiting for that one.
Reminds me, like, some of these studies just kind of come up with, like, the absolute funniest things. Like, for example, well, I was actually just listening to a podcast today about the claims of the Mormon Church and the ancestry of the Native American peoples. They claim that they were Israelite tribes, right? That came over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in 1870-ish, I think, when Joseph Smith was making these claims, I'm pretty sure he never dreamed of, you know, he thought it's an untestable claim. Here we are in 2014, and it's testable.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of genetic studies. The sum total of them found that 100% of the native population of North America is from a region in Siberia, I forget the name, but it's like they can pin it right down to, I think, near a lake in Kazakhstan or something like that. It's pretty cool. And I mean, you've got geneticist apologists for, like, there were in the mitochondrial DNA, I believe there were 5 major factors, and the top 4 factors comprised 96% of the genetic material.
Mm-hmm.
4% was harder to analyze. So you see the God of the gaps argument getting smaller and smaller. First it was 100%, then it was 4%, then when significant genetic studies happened on that 4%, that incredibly rare genetic frequency, that, and I mean, like, in any significant population, right, you're going to have, there's going to be some rare genes, right? Well, mm-hmm. this 4%, they found out it came from the exact same lake in Kamchatka, or not Kamchatka, I'm thinking that's Risk, Kazakhstan. It just took a little longer to properly study that, right? So then it's now gone down to, I think, a number that is quite close to zero, something like 0.004%. The point I'm trying to make is that when we start looking at science and stuff against religious claims, it's there's God of the gaps going on like crazy. It's everything's good until science chips away and chips away and chips away, and next thing you know, God is, you know, basically balancing on a pinhead of plausibility, mm-hmm. right? And with these near-death experiences, like, you take a look at this study, which seems relatively credible, you know, the objects on filing cabinets versus what passes for evidence in heaven is for real. The kid seeing his father praying in the operating lounge.
Or in the, yeah, in the lounge.
Are you kidding me? You don't think that would have happened either way? I mean, what else would his father have been doing?
Exactly. I agree. And who knows how much a four-year-old, like, I really don't know the story. I have not read the book. But four-year-olds absorb an awful lot around the house.
Oh boy, and, do they ever.
Yeah, so I think it would be easy for the child to be influenced, even unconsciously, totally unconsciously, by knowing what the parents are thinking about, or especially if you started talking about having an experience and then the father picked up on it and went, whoa, please tell me more. Yeah, so.
For sure, absolutely. I agree. And I mean, another thing, he recounted tales of stories that of things that happened before his birth. So that's a lock. It's a near-death experience. Like that's what passes for evidence, because I know absolutely nothing about the events that transpired prior to my birth. Nothing. And the fact that I do, and that I am aware of Roman history and all sorts of stuff indicates that I'm probably a vampire from True Blood. I could be up to 2,000 years old, Donna.
No doubt about it.
Yep.
I agree. And I'm actually, my belief is I'm the reincarnation of Marilyn Monroe.
Okay.
Because I was born like about 7 days after she passed away, so I just inherited that amazing likability and sexiness and, you know, hot stuff. So I agree.
Yep.
Greg, it has been a blast. It has been a blast. So, near-death experiences, yes or no? Are they? Do they really happen?
Oh, it's a phenomenon that happens. There's no doubt about it. I mean, do I dream? Absolutely. I have some really great dreams some nights, and they're a lot of fun. But are they real? No. They're products of my mind, and you can't separate my mind from me. It's all one big old package driven by chemistry. And that's the way it is. Chemistry and biology.
That's all.
I hate to sound like a stick in the mud here, but there ain't no souls around here.
Well, you got it, folks. We're just chemistry and biology.
I'm sorry if I don't know if anyone takes offense to that.
Greg, thank you. And I'm going to wrap it up there. That is it for today's episode of Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. You've been listening to Greg Christensen.
Goodbye, folks.
And me, I'm Donna Harris. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. If you have any questions or comments, or you'd like to suggest a topic for the show, send us an email at lueepodcast@winnipegskeptics.com. If you want to show your support, give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or just share the show with a friend. Our music is produced by the very talented Ian James, and this episode was edited by Ray Peterson.